Mid-40s tonight, tomorrow partly sunny, high in the mid-70s.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking by phone today with our guest Jennifer Bishop Jenkins about the death penalty and handgun violence. Jennifer, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Sure can, Steve.
Ah, wonderful. We're talking with Jennifer in the Houston Airport Employee Lounge, I understand. She's traveling and has made special efforts to be able to be on this program live today here on
As you know, I'm an Illinoisan, Steve, but I've been down here on the journey of hope from violence to healing with a wonderful group of murder victims' family members touring the whole state of Texas.
Now, let's let listeners know who may not know your family history, what you've been doing for the last 15 years and why.
In April of 1990 in Winnetka, Illinois, my sister, Nancy Bishop Langert, and her husband, Richard Langert, and their unborn child were murdered by a 16-year-old high school student in Winnetka. And that homicide, of course, just rocked the community and changed my life forever, our whole family. And
was the young man someone they knew?
Yes. He actually was a Winnetka resident also. Winnetka is a very prosperous community, and it was not a place where things like this ever happen, and it was quite a tragic blow to the whole community. He was a very promising young man. He had wealthy parents. He had a great education. He had great grades. He had a great deal of promise. But we found out later he was a sociopath, which means that he doesn't have really a formed conscience. And really, ultimately, the only thing that ever gave him a thrill or a rush was to see what he could get away with, what rules he could break and not get caught at. Thought he was smarter than everyone else and actually was obsessed, really intrigued, fascinated by guns, wanted to see what it would feel like to shoot someone. And so Nancy and Richard, who were living just across the street from the Winnetka police station, and his house was right behind the Winnetka police station, we believe he just picked them for that reason, that they were right in front of the police station. He was right behind it. It was like, look what I can do right under your nose and get away with it. And Nancy and Richard were in a townhouse directly across the street from that. And he broke into their house on a Saturday night. He held them at gunpoint. He tortured them. And my sister begged for the life of her child. She was only 25 years old. She was a beautiful, beautiful young woman. She and her husband, Richard, were the kindest, dearest, most beautiful people. And they had their whole lives ahead of them. They were expecting their first child. They were just getting ready to move into their first house, and they both had good jobs and had great education and a promising future. But instead, they were there in that townhouse on a Saturday night begging for their life as this young man held them at gunpoint. And ultimately, he took them down into the basement. When he got down into the basement, he held the .357 Magnum at point blank at the back of Richard's head and literally blew his brains out. Turned the gun on Nancy, who was collapsed crying to the basement floor. She crossed her arms over her pregnant belly and begged for the life of her child, please don't shoot me, please don't shoot my baby. And he pointed the gun directly at her abdomen and he fired, killing the baby, and then he fled. And really the hardest part for me emotionally has been the fact that, you know, over the months we realized that she did not die right away. She laid there on that basement floor dying for almost a half an hour. Her husband dead next to her, her baby dead inside her, and she was paralyzed and unable to get out, calling for help and not able to receive any. And ultimately, before she died, she pulled herself over by her husband, and the last thing she did as she lay dying with the very last ounce of strength in her body was to draw a heart and a U, the letters love you, in the blood around her husband's head, and that's when she died. And those last words of hers have been, as we will discuss, very transformative, very powerful for me.
Had the murderer done this before?
No. I mean, he had committed other crimes. He had actually created this. This was a high school student who, as I said, was intrigued by a very bright young man, but was intrigued by lawbreaking and had actually begun to commit a robbery. He had committed an assault. He had started to commit a list of crimes that he had created, but he was not yet, obviously, ever able to obtain a gun.
Was he captured quickly?
No. Unfortunately, there was a very prolonged and very agonizing investigation. Many crazy theories that abounded during the investigation. It turned into a multi-million dollar international investigation and really rather silly for it to have become that, because all along we kept thinking it's got to be something pretty close to home. But ultimately, the more headlines the story garnered, the more this young man at New Trier High School just began to brag to friends about what he had done. And he would joke about it and talk about it all the time, seemed to be obsessed with it. And ultimately, he did give one friend a lot of detail who didn't really know whether to believe him or not. And then sure. Later did finally go to the Winnetka police after he threatened to commit more crimes. So,
now, why did you respond the way you did in terms of the normal natural human response would be vengeance? And why did you choose to oppose the death penalty for someone who had murdered someone in your family?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think that without a doubt it wasn't me. It was really Nancy herself that gave me the gift of seeing the important things that needed to be done in the wake of this horrific tragedy. Nancy herself, as she lay there dying on that basement floor, you know, she was having to face the end of her life alone. And in those final moments, just imagine, what would you think about, what would you be feeling when she drew that heart and that you, that love you, with the last ounce of strength in her body? She was saying something quite profound, which is that love is the most important thing in the whole world. And it's something I think all of us know at a very fundamental level. I knew that to honor her and to carry on after her and to live days of life that she no longer had, that I had to do something to honor that and to keep that part of her alive. It was stunning to me that when they arrested the 16-year-old and charged him and we knew who had done it, that the very first thing that the public discussion was all about and all of the elected officials and all the police and everybody was, oh, how horrible that we can't give this young man the death penalty in Illinois because he's too young and we need to lower the death penalty age and that'll fix him and that's how we'll honor Nancy Bishop Langard. And it was, of course, a horrific thing to say to victims like us, to say that this is what our response is going to be. That doesn't help at all to start killing children to memorialize Nancy. That's not what she would have wanted. And it's certainly not anything that does anybody any good, because what we really need to do is identify the causes. We need to prevent violence. We need to keep this kind of thing from ever happening again. And so I spoke out, and my sister and I both spoke out and said, no, this is not how she would want to be honored. This is, and you can't use our case to justify this. And people were just stunned at our response that we didn't want the vengeance. It sort of propelled me into this, what has turned into a huge career for me of sorts, where I'm now involved with international murder victims organizations that work for human rights, murder victims' families for human rights. And we work against the death penalty, and I also work with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and the Million Mom March, and we do lots of things with the Cook County Juvenile Program to do crime prevention there. All of these things that I'm trying to do to prevent violence and prevent more violence, and that's the way that I think you need to respond if you really want to honor those that you love and really want to make a difference, not just pay lip service to vengeance.
Now, your background is education. What do you make of the argument that says we have to teach people that this kind of violence is wrong by showing that there's a tremendous penalty, the death penalty, if you do it? Do you not make anything of the deterrence argument?
Right, yeah, and it's true. I was a teacher for 25 years. I've been a high school social studies teacher for 25 years. Just left that to do this work with the Brady Campaign, which is very exciting. I'll tell you, what you have just articulated, Steve, is called deterrence, that a punishment will deter the crime. And that's a very deep-seated idea in our culture. It goes, you know, to the very core of how we were raised as children, you know, that the threat of punishment from our parents will deter us from bad behavior. Deterrence does work to a certain extent, but lethal deterrence does not. And we actually have overwhelming evidence that the death penalty not only doesn't deter, but it actually seems to have, counterintuitively perhaps, an inverse effect. Where there is the death penalty, these are the most violent places. And where we do not have the death penalty in our country, the lesser violent places. Because you create a culture of death. You say in your laws and in your very constitution and in your social structure that it's okay to kill, that the state can kill, and it's very hard to argue to mentally ill people or people who've had horrific trauma or pain in their lives. You can't kill, but the state can. I mean, it's an absolutely wrong message. And then if you start thinking about why it is that deterrence doesn't work with the death penalty and actually seems to attract, in some cases, we actually have people going to states where they have the death penalty who are suicidal and want to kill themselves and can't bring themselves to do it, so it actually sometimes attracts people to murder. But in essence, the death penalty would argue that anybody about to murder somebody would stop and evaluate the consequences of their actions at the time they're about to commit it. And we all know that that doesn't happen. Almost everyone, and I've been visiting prisons for 15 years now, almost everyone that is a murderer has either a serious drug problem or a serious mental health problem, or it's an act of extreme passion and extreme desperation in a spur-of-the-moment crisis. It's almost never, ever someone carefully and methodically balancing out consequences and making choices. So deterrence, we know, just doesn't work. And all you have to do is see the crime rate in places like Texas and Oklahoma that kill people very, very regularly to know that clearly it's not about deterrence. In fact, it's interesting, even those states that are executing a lot don't even say that anymore. They have stopped saying this is about deterrence. They are now saying it's about revenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the appropriate punishment. You know, vengeance is the right way to respond. They've killed, so we're going to kill them, and that's the end of it. So they don't even argue deterrence anymore.
Now, after this happened in your family, Jennifer, you were one of the founding members of this Murder Victim Families Against the Death Penalty for Human Rights.
Yes.
This group had not existed before. How did you start it?
I actually was one of a group of people. I didn't wholly start it. It was actually started by a New Hampshire state legislator named Vernie Cushing, whose father was shot, and a whole group of us all across the country. And even there, we have international, as I said, a reach. We have families from Japan, families from Uzbekistan, who have come together on this belief that more violence is not going to solve the problem. We really do have a unique voice as murder victims' family members, a unique moral authority to say that killing is not the solution. We need to take the resources, the precious resources, and do something better with it, better for victims and more to prevent crime. So we actually began Murder Victims' Families for Human Rights at an international conference on the death penalty that was held, a World Congress in Montreal. And it was actually born at the United Nations on Human Rights Day, December 10th, just last year, is when we inaugurated the organization.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Jennifer Bishop Jenkins from Murder Victims' Families for Human Rights. And listeners are encouraged to join the conversation. Do give us a call anywhere the program is heard. You may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL for a toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, where the WILL studio is, you may reach several local lines here by punching in 333-9455. So in the Champaign-Urbana area, if it's a local call, do use 333-WILL with comments or questions for our guest today. We're going to be talking about the Brady campaign as well to prevent gun violence. This is something fairly new that you've been involved with personally, is that correct?
Right. I got involved actually almost right from the beginning, not just working against the death penalty, but also working against gun violence because I began to see that it was this young man's fascination and attraction with guns, which was really his primary motive. And I began to need to understand what it is that is so obsessive in our culture about guns. Why do we tolerate, as a society, 82 gun violence deaths a day in this nation, 36,000 gun violence deaths a year? Why do we tolerate that and allow an organization like the National Rifle Association to push for more and more extreme and bizarre and dangerous kinds of liberal gun laws that are just incredibly harmful to our society. Why do we continue to tolerate that when we have this culture of young men that, you know, are fascinated to replicate what they see happening in the movies? And and you know, it's very, very scary. So
does it tend to be mainly men?
Well, yes, but certainly not, you know, not entirely. I mean, I know it's a preponderance of men, but it's, you know, it's, there's a gun-loving culture that crosses all boundaries in this culture, but it is primarily rural white men that are the predominance of it. But certainly this young man was a suburban teenager who just, again, his only motive for shooting these three beloved people was to see what it would feel like to do that. So you have to kind of wonder what goes on with our culture that we raise amongst us young men that are just, you know, willing to do that. The Million Mile March happened in 2000, and I got to go to that, and I got really involved with other victims of gun violence, and went on to become the Illinois State Million Mile President, and then was very, very blessed to start working full-time with the Brady Campaign just this year. So Illinois is a very important place because we've got a wonderful opportunity in Illinois that politically just doesn't seem to be possible in other places to really do some good things. I think there's a lot of people in Illinois that get that we need to have some reasonable restrictions on access to guns. We need background checks. We need universal background checks.
Let me interrupt just a moment because we do have a caller waiting. I want to get back to what the Brady Campaign is going to be doing, particularly in Illinois, but let's go to line one with a caller with a question for our guest, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have a comment. One thing that frightens me about the death penalty is that sometimes people are condemned to death for crimes they didn't commit. And, of
right.
course, there's no way to undo that.
Right.
It's so irrevocable.
Right.
That's all I wanted to say.
Well, that's a very profound observation. I mean, in fact, you know, even if we are only killing the guilty, I would still have great moral objection. But you raise a huge point, which is that we cannot, as human beings, we know, can't administer a system that will not make mistakes. And, of course, we already have made a ton of them in Illinois and had a very courageous governor who was willing to fix that, at least tried to. And I know that in other places across the country, in fact, I'm in Houston, Texas right now because I've been with a group of folks that are traveling across Texas talking about the same thing. We have 120 exonerated men in this country that have come off death row, and many more that we have not gotten off death row, and we have actually executed some that were innocent, and we have found out later were actually innocent. And you just cannot take that kind of chance. You can't play God. You can't do the permanent and the irrevocable punishment when you're human beings, infallible and capable of error.
We know
the death penalty only is applied massively to the poor, and it's a huge tool, a weapon, really, a sociological weapon against the poor.
How safe do you feel in Texas speaking against guns?
I suppose not very. It is a very different culture, and I'm grateful for my Midwestern roots, so I think that are much more sensible on this issue. There is an obsessive, almost, love of guns and killing here that is very hard to be around. I'm glad I'm flying home tonight.
We have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, line four. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Very interesting, and I do appreciate your guest's remarkable honesty and being candid about a very, very difficult situation that happened to her own family. I'm going to ask your guest to be a bit psychological, though I'm sure she's seen the paradox, probably especially in Texas, but it always strikes me as quite fascinating that so many Christians are so adamantly pro-life, meaning the issue of abortion. Mm-hmm. Yet when it comes to handgun control, if you bring up the issue, they act as if you're crazy, you're from another planet, or you're trying to eliminate all guns, which I think is virtually impossible. And it seems that those very same people often want to offer a violent solution, such as the current president's insane war in Iraq, and a violent solution for everything, including, as you were just talking, capital punishment. I wonder if you could just discuss that for a little bit and give me your own views as you see the paradox. I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Great. No, I really... I have to say I really agree with that gentleman. I am troubled by those in the religious right who claim to be conservative for life and then will stand for the death penalty and not want to have restrictions. They are the liberals on this issue of guns. They're the ones who want liberal gun laws. They don't want common sense, safe, moderate limitations. And it's very difficult to see the way those issues have aligned. I couldn't agree more. If you are, quote, pro-life, unquote, our Cardinal Bernardine from Chicago, bless his heart before he died, was the voice in American Christianity that articulated the idea of a seamless garment, that you are, if you're for life, then you're for life in all ways. And he went to visit death row even as he had cancer and was dying himself. It is not pro-life to be pro-guns and to be pro-death penalty.
Jennifer, you mentioned earlier that you also have visited prisons and prisoners. Why did you do that?
I would say that's probably the hardest part for me to explain to other folks, that I needed to be able to talk to murderers. The murderer in my case was not willing or able to talk to our family. And I needed to understand. I just needed to look it right in the face, and I needed to be able to talk to people, ask them questions, come to understand it, try to help others that were wanting to reconcile, even though reconciliation was not possible in our case because the young man was so unrepentant. But we have a marvelous opportunity to go in prison and really find out what went wrong and learn from that and then try to take that out and fix it. And so I started visiting Pontiac Death Row, and I've been visiting prisons for about 10 years, and I've come to understand what goes wrong in people's lives. And now that I've seen it face-to-face, I really do feel much better equipped to come out and talk to people and try to help and try to prevent violence. And that's what really has led my husband and I, my husband Bill Jenkins, who's also a murder victim's family member, we met at a murder victim's conference. We now go out together in Cook County in Chicago area, and we do victim impact panels with the juveniles in the probation system in Chicago. We actually work for crime prevention. We go to the kids that are already in trouble with the law, already headed in a wrong path in their life, and we do this wonderful program that Cook County does with their juveniles called victim impact panels, where the kids have to listen to victims and have to talk with us, and they have to, as part of their sentence, part of their probation, they have to come face-to-face with people who've experienced real harm, and they have to see that the real-life consequences to their actions. And so this is the kind of thing we're trying to do. We understand from visiting prisons that, you know, what goes wrong. And remember that almost everybody that goes into a prison in our whole country is going to someday come out of it. Very few people die in prison, either executed or stayed in there for life. The vast majority of our prison population, which is, by the way, 2 million people in this country, a huge number, the largest percentage. All these international human rights organizations actually discovered that the United States has the largest percentage of its own population incarcerated of any culture in world history. So we have over 2 million Americans in prison, incarcerated, and the vast majority of them someday are going to be out again. And we have to, as a society, come to confront that. We have to understand what goes wrong. We have to start talking in our culture again about rehabilitation. We have to build bridges of reconciliation. And I am part of a new national dialogue, which has been going on for some years, called Restorative Justice or Transformative Justice, which is a new way of looking at our justice system, that we have to rebuild communities and we have to find out ways to help people who are in trouble.
When you go into a prison and talk to the youth, perhaps with your husband as part of this victim impact panel, how do the people respond? The people who have committed crimes, maybe not murder yet, but they're in prison most likely for a drug offense, maybe a victimless crime.
Right.
How do they learn from this?
Well, the victim impact panels are done with juveniles in Cook County that are on probation, so they're not behind bars, they're not incarcerated, or they're only in a minimal incarceration.
Uh-huh.
These are kids we're hoping to catch before they get into deeper and much more serious problems. They have assault charges or car theft or drugs or gang banging, but not not the heavy duty stuff yet. Mm-hmm. And what we get from them is, you know, pretty much a lot of them come and saying, oh, God, why do I have to sit through this presentation? Well, you know, this is the judge is making me do this. And a lot of them will come out afterwards, they'll come up and with tears in their eyes, and they'll say, you really made me think about things, and I'm really glad you came, and I promise I'll think about what you said. And I really talked to those kids about what's wrong with the 16-year-old that murdered my three family members. You know, what? Why would a kid who had so many things going for him be so intrigued by violence that he would actually throw it all away like that, that he would murder three people, that he would throw away his whole future just because he wasn't fascinated by it? And so that's a story that actually has some real real reach with these kids that we talk to in Cook County. As far as going into the prison, the reaction I get from the people there is just one of deep gratitude, because most of those guys that are incarcerated have grown much older, much wiser. They've gotten off the drugs that they were on. And, you know, they see things in a new light, and they really do want to try to make a difference for good, a lot of them.
We're about halfway through our program of Keeping the Faith this Sunday afternoon with our guest, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, who's been talking with us, representing the murder victims' families for human rights and also the Brady Campaign against gun violence, to prevent gun violence. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment about that. But I need to take a short break just to remind listeners that public radio depends upon volunteer donors who appreciate the services, the programs that you hear on public radio and public television for contributions. And this is a pledge period again for WILL radio and television. And each listener who gains something from these programs needs to feel that they need to return something to keep this coming, because these programs are only possible because of the generosity of listeners. And if you'd like to make a pledge, you may call Pledge Central. That's 217-244-9455. So please notice that's a different number than to call to be on the air and ask a question to our guest, which we'll return to in just a moment. But if you'd like to make a pledge, please call 217-244-WILL. It's very important that listeners contribute as small a gift. It doesn't matter how small. Please do what you can. And those who are able to do more, please do, to keep these kind of quality programs with dealing with very important topics coming through WILL. So do call 217-244-9455. They'll accept credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. You may also check online, willpledge.org, willpledgealtogether.org, to make a pledge. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. I'm the executive director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest student organization at the university. It has been on this campus since 1873, encouraging students to be involved in social action and community service, becoming aware of some of the big issues of our time. We have wonderful student volunteers. We have wonderful programs with students. But in addition, we have a speaker program, and we bring fascinating people to campus. And our guest today on the radio will be in Champaign-Urbana on October 21st. That's a Friday, as part of the WISE Friday Forum program at noon. And she'll be talking about facing the death penalty, a victim's conscience. Jennifer Bishop Jenkins will be at the Y on at Friday Forum at noon. It's a free lecture. You may call ahead and reserve some good Thai food if you'd like. The Y number is 337-1500. But that's this coming Friday, October 21. Coming up on Know Your University, also at the Y this coming Tuesday, will be a wonderful music program, the Pacifica Quartet. The quartet in residence here at the University of Illinois, as well as the University of Chicago, will be playing Bartok, Bella Bartok's music, this coming Tuesday, October 18, a free concert with a chance for question and answers with these wonderful musicians. That's Tuesday at noon at the Y, 1001 South Wright Street, in Champaign. I have two quick announcements I need to make. One relates to another of the Y programs. We're looking for teachers, for instructors for our community classes. CUNY-Versity has been going on at the Y for many years, since the early 70s, and we depend upon community members to design and teach all the courses we offer. Some of our teachers have been teaching things like dance and photography for the last 20 years at the Y, but we're always looking for new programs. So if you have something you know that you'd like to share with others, you can get a small fee for that, and the Y gets a little bit of money. But if you have an idea for a class, do check us out. You can look at our website, universityymca.org/communiversity, or you may call 337-1514 during the week. Ask for Paul or Becca. Paul Heiberger is our CUNY-Versity coordinator, and he'll be happy to help you set up a class and tell you how to do it. We're looking for teachers to start teaching next semester. We need to have these applications done by December 30, and the classes start in January. So, that's CUNY-Versity. And one other announcement, the Religious Studies Program in the East Asian Language and Culture Department and the Prairie Zen Center are bringing in a speaker October 24 and 25. That's a Monday and a Tuesday, to talk about Buddhism. And if you'd like to hear Hayun Jimeng, who is a real expert in contemporary Chinese Buddhism, he'll be speaking two different times, on the 24th from 3 to 4 in the Illini Union, room 314, and he'll be then speaking on Tuesday, the 25th of October from 1 to 5. It's sort of a long seminar at Illini Union, again, room 405. So, if you want to learn about Buddhist meditation, we have a real expert coming to campus October 24 and 25. If you have questions, contact the Religious Studies Program at the University of Illinois or the Prairie Zen Center. Well, back to our guest today, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, and we do have a caller. Jennifer, are you still
sure.
with us in Houston? Great.
Sure.
Let's go to line one. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I want to ask your guest a little bit about her reaction to Michael Moore's documentary, Bowling for Columbine. It's been a while since I've seen it, but if I remember correctly, the number of guns that we have per capita in the U.S. is about the same as what is found in Canada, but we have such a high gun death rate as opposed to Canada and any other country in the world. And I was wondering if you would be interested in speaking about the reasons that you think that might be, and I will hang up and listen off the air.
Thank you very much for the call.
Great question. A very perceptive caller. Michael Moore's point in that film, and I've met the man and talked to him, it's a brilliant film. His point is that what drives the biggest problem here is fear. The enemy here is our fear of each other, the culture of fear, the culture of violence, that we're constantly on, you know, everything from terror alerts to, you know, anthrax alerts to, you know, we're constantly looking for the enemy, the other among us, and there is a culture of fear. There's a lack of community, a real sense of alienation amongst ourselves, and when you well-arm that kind of fear, you end up with a lot more gun violence. In fact, we do have a much higher per capita presence of guns in our culture than other cultures do. Canada's numbers are definitely lower, although not hugely lower. But the gun violence rate in our country is so much dramatically more high than other countries. It's just it's like night and day. It skyrockets. I mean, we have in Germany like two gun violence deaths a year, and we have 36,000 in the United States. The numbers are just not even close. And you really have to, you know, get at the cause of that. I mean, a lot of it is how easy it is to get the guns in the wrong hands, and the lack of background checks, the wrong kinds of. There's just no reason, for example, for in our culture to have, and they don't have this in other countries, assault weapons, high capacity magazines, armor piercing bullets, all of these things that are being marketed by a highly profit driven gun industry. And you have in Illinois a lot of manufacturers of guns like Armalite that are located in Illinois, and they carry a tremendous amount of weight. And remember, that whole gun lobby, the whole NRA thing, it's all funded by multi-billion-dollar industries. So those of us that work against gun violence victims, we don't have a multi-billion-dollar industry backing our efforts at peacemaking. We are faced with a hugely profitable industry that doesn't care whose hands these guns go into. And they actually feed the culture of fear. They make money off of the very cultural fear that the documentary was trying to talk about. The more we can convince people that they need to arm themselves against each other and, we just create that cycle of violence and continue to accelerate it. It's stunning to me to see when there was a shooting at Red Lake in the school in Minnesota that the only answer they could say was, well, we need to arm all the teachers. You know, that's not the response. We have to go to the heart and soul of what goes wrong with kids and why people feel like they need to pick up a gun in the first place before we can really address those problems. But I think that the culture of fear is something that we really do need to talk about and why it is that the gun industry seems to actually play on that and seems to enjoy creating it in order to increase their profits.
What should people be afraid of?
A lack of community. I mean, what we need to stop being afraid of each other and start building community relationships with each other that are, the more heavily populated a society is, I realize how difficult that is. But the reason that 16-year-old shot my sister and her husband and their baby is because even though they live two blocks away from him, he felt no sense of connection to them whatsoever, no community, no bond, no connection of humanity. And as a result, he was able to shoot them. And it's because he lacked that I know that we're all still needing to do some very hard work. So what we should be afraid of is people who won't stand up and say, you know, corporate gun industry profits are not what's most important. What's most important is that we keep our children safe. And if we have a huge political lobby that refuses to even work with victims of violence to regulate the very industry that they're supposed to be representing the interests of, you know, that's just irresponsible beyond belief. They will not even sit down with victims of violence and try to talk about ways to regulate their own products in ways that will keep them safe. We don't allow car manufacturers to do that. We make them talk with us about seat belts and fenders and, you know, glass that's shatterproof and all of the kinds of products, consumer product safety standards that we ask of every other product industry on the market. But yet the NRA refuses to sit down at the table and have the same kinds of conversations about how to keep them out of the wrong hands and how to do better, safer access to, you know, legal firearms when people want to hunt or want to keep one for self-defense. You know, there are ways to do that and do it safely and do it with moderation. Nobody needs armor-piercing bullets. Nobody needs assault weapons. Nobody needs high-capacity magazines. And the NRA should not be fighting background checks. And they do. They fight them all the time. And that scares me. That should scare us all, that they oppose, with millions of dollars in lobbying money, that they oppose universal background checks. That should frighten people.
This is a live call-in program every week on WILL, Keeping the Faith, and we do talk about issues of spirituality, religion, ethics, and values. And, of course, in talking about this issue, we're dealing with a very important ethical issue for our time. If you'd like to join the conversation with our guest, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, do give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet. Many people tune into this station on WILL.UIUC.edu, and then, in this case, click on AM 580. Our programs are archived, and if you've missed part of this discussion with Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, would like to hear the complete program, in a couple weeks it'll be available, and you may go to that website, WILL.UIUC.edu, and click on Keeping the Faith, and these programs are there for several years so that you can hear the whole program and share it with others. In Champaign-Urbana, you may call a local number to be live on the air with our guest, 333-9455. We have several local lines. So do give us a call with a comment or question. Jennifer, in talking about the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence, what do you do?
Well, we're actually trying to just support some very good gun violence prevention leaders in our state right now. Really, in Illinois, we are blessed with a broad consensus across our political leadership, from our governor to the mayor of Chicago to our two wonderfully, I just think, fabulous. I think we have the two best senators in the United States. Dick Durbin and Barack Obama are wonderful men, both committed to gun safety and other great policies. Gun violence, the liberal gun laws of the NRA are failed public policy, and we need to support the work of our elected officials that want to have sound public policy. Governor Blagojevich and Mayor Daley and many of the state legislators like John Cullerton and Terry Link and Karen May and Harry Osterman and Deb Graham, and there are many, many state legislators that have done wonderful work for gun safety legislation in this state, and you know, we're hoping to pass an assault weapons ban, because there, when the federal government last year allowed the assault weapons ban nationally to expire under pressure from the NRA, which owns George Bush's White House, it was very disturbing to gun violence victims like me that even though President Bush had said he would support an assault weapons ban renewal, he did nothing to make it happen, and that was tremendously disappointing to people like me who were gun violence victims. And we're expecting leadership from him on that issue and failed to see it. And that ban expired, and now there were literally orders coming from actual Al-Qaeda members internationally to Armalite here in Illinois, waiting to get those assault weapons as soon as they became legal last September of 2004. So we have to, in Illinois, get a ban passed in our state, and there are other states working on that. We're also really trying to see universal background checks. We just, in Illinois, closed the gun show loophole here. Just a couple months ago, Governor Blagojevich signed that, and what that did is it mandated background checks at gun shows. But we still have many loopholes left to close, private sales, flea markets, garage sales, places where guns can be exchanged and not and no background check.
We have another caller waiting on line one. Let's go to that question or comment. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm absolutely against violence, and I turned in sort of late. I wanted to know if your guest has any other thoughts about how to prevent violence. It seems to me we had a lot. I had three boys, and I wondered how I could prevent violence with them and with my grandkids. And I'll hang up and listen to them.
Oh, it's such a broad and wonderful question. I mean, how, you know, there are so many things that we all need to do. I mean, there are peace and justice programs in every facet of our society, in our churches and in our schools, ways that we can do, you know, mental health programs I think are incredibly important, where we try to look at ways like the kid who killed my sister, what goes wrong with young people who are attracted to violence. I mean, I think that what we have to do ultimately is be very logical about what works. It doesn't work to have a society that's riddled with violence. It doesn't work to have a lot of killing. It's expensive. It's incredibly expensive. We have so much money that we have to sink into insurance and medical costs, all because we have such an incredibly violent society. And if we really got proactive and got on top of violence as a social issue, we would save ourselves. I mean, let's just be mercenary about it and talk about the money we would save, not to mention the much greater quality of life. So it really should be a national priority. And just as we have treated smoking as a public health crisis and really tried to address it across the board with prevention programs and with health treatment programs and with education programs, you know, we can address gun violence the same way. We can address the death penalty the same way. We have to use good scientific information and broad education programs and lots of discussions at every level of government and in the community to just commit ourselves to end the violence that is around us, because there's a ton of it, and it is hugely costly in every way.
Another listener is waiting on our toll-free line. Line four, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a little concerned about the way this topic is going, because I am a conservative and I do believe in guns, and I am against gun violence. But I think what your guest is forgetting is we were giving a right to bear arms, not to protect me against you, but protect the people of this country against the government. And you can't disarm the people without risking losing every right that we have.
Sir, could I ask you a question? Have you heard me advocating disarming anybody other than people that shouldn't have them?
The people that shouldn't have them will always be able to get them.
Okay.
A person that wants to do something illegal will do it. The people that will do it legally are the people that you're going to take them from.
Well, we're not, I mean, please understand that the gun safety movement is not interested in grabbing.
Oh, yes, it is. In every country
I think
that you've
ever
done
talking.
This,
I believe
in every
that is
country
the fear
that this has ever been done, you end up disarming the people. And the only people you disarm are the honest people.
I think universal background checks and trying to keep assault weapons out of hands of criminals and illegal trafficking is something that all owners of guns, as well as those people that choose not to own guns, this is something we can all agree on. This is something we can come together on.
Okay,
and I think
but
we
aren't
need
agreeing
to come
on
together
it.
On issues like
I
that.
Mean, your side is agreeing because you want to take away the guns from honest people.
I'm not advocating that, and I think you're hearing things that aren't there, and I do believe that's the fear talk.
No, ma'am. I am just looking at history. I'm looking at what Adolf Hitler did. I'm looking at what tyranny and people that do, and you guys mislead. You mentioned Michael Moore. Did you? He lied about the statistics in his Bowling for Columbine movie. Even the part where he was in a bank buying a gun, that was all set up. It wasn't even true.
Actually, I don't want to go there. You should go to factcheck.org. It actually, he actually does a good job of defending that. But that's
you're saying that he was in that bank, that those people.
Let me
were
just
bankers?
Ask you this: you're clearly a gun owner and a gun lover. Let me ask you this question: do you oppose universal background checks?
Universal background checks?
Yes. Would you oppose universal background?
Well, in my county, in my state, if I'm going to have a handgun, I have to have a background check.
I understand it. So, do you think that everyone should have to have background checks?
What I oppose is what the liberals do, and this is always done, is you come in and you put in a law. Then you add to it. How do you stop, you say assault weapons, how do you stop a regular .22 caliber automatic rifle? It fires no different than an assault rifle. They just look different. So at that point, you will just add to the law and you'll take them away from us. That's why the gun people will not give in, because we know what you will do.
Well, I think that only the most extreme kinds of gun liberality are the things that I'm concerned about. I think that the vast majority of gun owners do support universal background checks. They don't think things like armor-piercing bullets should be on the market. They don't believe that we have any need for assault weapons. Right now in
you
Illinois,
don't
there's
understand,
a gun. There's a
I don't believe
gun
that you understand that an assault rifle is the same thing as a regular semi-automatic rifle.
You support,
they just look different.
I understand that. Do you believe
so you're calling it an assault rifle, and you're really talking about just regular rifles.
Okay, why does a person like you need a high-capacity magazine that can shoot 50 bullets?
I need it to protect me from my government. That was my right. That was, people have
why
died
Why do you need
more.
A silencer on your gun? You know, there's a lot of things that are put onto these guns that are directly targeting criminals and not helping. It's not a legitimate thing at all. We don't need 50 caliber assault rifles, or these sniper rifles that are legal in our state right now that we would like to see taken away. It can take down an airplane. Can kill people from miles away. There's no legitimate sporting or self defense purpose for a weapon that large and that heavy. And these are the kinds of things that these are the reasonable.
If we have a foreign power come into this country, it would be very hard for them to take this country from the people of this country if they're armed. If they're not armed, then you can come in and walk all over us. That's why we were given the right.
Well, I'm not in fear of foreign invasion. I think we have a strong military, and I don't believe that it's beneficial to have the public carrying those kinds of high-capacity
weapons. Well, ma'am,
I
hope you're right, but if you're wrong, then it will be people like myself and people all over this country that save your rights.
I think that I hear in you a lot of the fear we were talking about, fear of invasion, fear of being taken over, and really...
No, ma'am, I want my rights. I want my rights that the Constitution gave to me, that the forefathers set forth and for 200 years have been upheld, and people like you are trying to take them away, and I don't like it.
I'm sad that you feel threatened enough that you are living, so strongly.
I am always threatened by liberals. Always.
No, I believe that gun policies of the NRA are really the most liberal. And I really do think that we have a huge public health issue with gun violence in our country. And it's sad that the people on your side of the issue won't sit down and dialogue with us about how to stop that.
Well, it may be sad, ma'am, but the people like me are the people that die in the wars, so that people like you can go on radio and try and rally support to take away guns. It's silly. We've had the right. We were given the right, and that's why people...
You're comfortable with 82 people dying from gun violence in this country every day. You're comfortable with that number. You don't think that's a social problem that we need to address?
A social problem? It's not the gun. I mean, you're making it like the gun is the problem.
The guns are the problem.
You just admitted that it's a social problem.
If it's a social problem,
then cure the social ill.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what some of the social ills might be with our guest. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call and for expressing your opinion. Back to our guest, Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, who is speaking from the perspective of having her own sister murdered by a 16-year-old with a gun in the state of Illinois.
It's always very troubling to hear people so concerned about protecting themselves from unseen threat that they're willing to live with a culture that is so heavily armed and so obsessed with army itself. And you hear the same kind of platitudes over and over again from people that are in the NRA. They always try to cite, Hitler and things like that in the past when, taking their guns away meant a lack of freedom. But in actuality, there's no attempts to do that here. There's just some reasonable safety things that we could all come together and agree with. And the vast majority, by the way, of NRA members do support background checks and assault weapons bans and things like that because they're reasonable and they make sense for our society.
You were talking about some of the size of weapons that people can legally own at this point.
Yeah, scary. Really scary.
I don't know enough about guns to know what that means.
Well, there's a 50 caliber sniper rifle that the governor would like to see, I think, on a list of weapons that would get banned. I actually got to hold one at a gun show just a few weeks ago. It weighs about 40 pounds. It's extremely heavy. It's not a carryable gun. It has a huge bullet. It can actually... on a takeoff or landing, it could take down an airplane. It can shoot and accurately kill people from a mile or two or more away. It can actually hit a target up to 5 miles away. It has silencers and flash suppressors on it, and it's an extremely lethal weapon, and it's a military weapon. And there's no reason for it to be able to be available for purchase, and it's being trafficked internationally. It's being manufactured in our country and being trafficked internationally, and it's an extremely dangerous weapon, and we shouldn't have them for sale here.
What do you make about our last caller's argument that civil defense is finally in the hands of the people, needs to be in the hands of the people?
Well, the Second Amendment that he was loving to cite was actually about a well-regulated militia, and everyone knows that that's what it's about. The Supreme Court has ruled consistently that that's what it's about, a well-regulated militia, and that's the police department, the National Guard, and the United States military. And I'm not trying to take his guns away if he likes to hunt, if he wants to keep a gun in the home for self-defense. But the kinds of things we're talking about is how to keep guns out of the hands of kids, how to keep highly lethal weapons out of the hands of people who would be able to kill a lot of people at one time. There's no reason why an assault rifle should be allowed because it's going to be able to take out a whole lot of people at one time, and that's a pretty scary thing. I mean, there are reasonable things I think that we can all agree on. I think that, when you look at what's really going to make a difference in saving lives in this country, we have to be able to courageously stand up to a very powerful industry that makes billions of dollars off of the kind of fear that man was articulating, We have to instead say we want to keep our culture safe. Here's a really do we have time for a really quick interesting story about
We're down to our last 2 minutes.
Okay, well, just a quick story about the NRA. The NRA was actually offered by a wealthy businessman the opportunity to put on their office building the entire Second Amendment, and they refused because they only wanted the part on the Second Amendment that said the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They don't want the first part of the Second Amendment, which deals with well-regulated militias. They refused it because they know that the Second Amendment doesn't support their argument. And I just found it very interesting that they actually refused that offer, knowing that they always try to use it as part of their propaganda. It really is just propaganda of fear, and I know that everyone listening does care about violence prevention, and so we can come together and decide to really dialogue about the best ways. Let's sit down at the table with all points of view, and let's dialogue about the best ways to reduce deaths in our culture.
And in our last minute, how many people support your movement?
You mean in the gun violence prevention?
Sure. The Brady campaign.
Millions. Certainly Brady is a huge national organization, and in polls, just public opinion polls, we had a huge national consensus on assault weapons ban. We had a huge national consensus on the issues of immunity for the gun violence, for the gun industry, which is about to pass the United States Congress, where they want to take away the rights of victims to sue. There's universal, almost universal, vast majority supporting these things. But because of the fact that there's not a well-funded lobby behind them, they're not getting the bills through the NRA-run U.S. Congress.
And does the Brady Campaign have a website?
Yes, it does, and that's at thebradycampaign.org. And also, Murder Victims Families for Human Rights can be reached at www.murdervictimsfamilies.org.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, who's very kindly has sat on a telephone in the employee lounge at the Houston airport where she's traveling. And we thank you very much for being able to find a telephone that we could talk with you today at this time.
Steve, I look forward to folks coming out to the University Y next Friday, and we can continue this dialogue. And I hope that everyone that was listening and called in will come out, and we can talk more about these important issues, because dialogue is what it's all about.
Thank you. Thank you for participating, and thank you to our callers. For those who would like to meet Jennifer Bishop Jenkins personally and hear her speak, that'll be next Friday, October 21st, at the University YMCA on the campus of the University of Illinois, 1001 South Wright Street, easily accessible by bus, and occasionally there are parking spaces even on campus at noontime on Fridays as students take off. So do come for that program. If you'd like to reserve a lunch, call the Y, 217-337-1500. Our guest next week on Keeping the Faith will be Professor Jim Quigley, talking about energy conservation. That'll be on Keeping the Faith, October 23rd. The following week, our guest will be someone else speaking on peacemaking. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Anderson Foundation, Devereaux TPAC, Danville, and Jarman Senior Apartments in Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Support for today's broadcast is provided by Outback Concerts, presenting Alison Krauss and Union Station featuring Jerry Douglas, live in concert at Braden Auditorium on October 20th. More information at Ticketmaster.com.
Welcome to WBEZ Chicago. It's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass, and it's a special pledge drive edition of our program. And we have a brand new special pledge drive premium, a thank you gift that we want to send you. And I'll be talking about that as the hour proceeds. But first, let's just start things off with one of the most popular stories that we've ever put on our show, actually. This is show that we put on the air where our senior producer, Julie Snyder, and I went out to a summer camp to simply document what happens at a typical summer camp over the course of a summer. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting to see is that, you know, you think about little kids today, you know, and they have all this stuff in their lives. They've got DVDs and video games and email. You know, they have all this stuff. But yet,